Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we are tackling a really big one, a truly foundational text, Karl von Clausewitz on War.
That's vom Krieg in the original German. And yeah, it's got a reputation, doesn't it? Dense, maybe a bit intimidating.
Definitely. It's one of those books you see on shelves, people quote it all the time, generals, CEOs, you name it, but actually reading it cover to cover, that's another story.
Right. And you might be thinking, okay, 19th century Prussian general,
yep.
What's that got to do with me?
Exactly. If you're not planning a military campaign, why dive into this?
Well, because it's not really about battle plans or troop formations, not at its core. It's more a framework for thinking.
Thinking about what, though?
About competition, about strategy, risk, and really about that messy gap between a plan and what actually happens. That applies everywhere.
Okay, so that's our mission today. Cut through the complexity, maybe ignore the detailed battle analyses for now, and pull out the really essential ideas. Because the book's central point isn't tactical advice. It's a deep dive into what war actually is.
And what is it, according to Clausewitz?
Fundamentally, a political tool. An instrument of policy. That's the absolute core we need to grasp. So we're aiming for the shortcut to understanding this profound piece of work.
Sounds good. So let's start with the man himself.
Okay.
Karl von Clausewitz, born 1780, died 1831, Prussian general, historian, and obviously a hugely influential military thinker.
And the key thing is this wasn't abstract theorizing from like an armchair general, was it?
Yeah, not at all. He started young, joined the army at 12. He lived through the Napoleonic Wars.
Wow, 12.
Yeah. So he saw the old ways of limited sort of gentlemanly warfare completely swept away by Napoleon's total nationalistic approach. He was in it.
He saw the chaos firsthand.
Definitely. He was part of the massive Prussian defeat at Jena-Auerstedt in 1806.
Mm-hmm.
Experiences like that, hell, they stick with you. They shaped his whole view,
yeah.
His push for military reform in Prussia.
So it's this blend of direct, often brutal experience on the battlefield, combined with this really deep philosophical reflection afterwards. He wasn't just a soldier. He was trying to understand the very nature of what he'd been through. Later, he directed the Prussian War College, too.
And here's a really interesting detail about the book itself, On War. He never actually finished it.
Right. He died suddenly from cholera.
Yeah, in 1831.
Yeah.
And it was his wife, Marie von Bruhl, who gathered all his manuscripts, his notes, his drafts.
An incredible task.
Absolutely. She compiled it and published it after his death. And you can kind of feel that, I think. It has this raw, exploratory feel sometimes, like you're seeing his thinking evolve. It's not overly polished.
Which makes it feel more authentic, maybe. Less like a rigid doctrine.
Exactly. Which brings us to the book itself. What is it? First thing to know, it's not a rule book. It's not a checklist for winning.
So no 7 habits of highly effective generals.
Huh, no, nothing like that. It's philosophical. It's designed to give you a mental toolkit, a way to think critically and adaptively about conflict, about any competitive situation, really.
And the absolute bedrock of that thinking is the connection between war and politics.
Yes, that famous line. War is the continuation of politics by other means.
Okay, let's unpack that because it's quoted so often, maybe it loses its punch. Does it just mean politicians start wars?
It's deeper than that. It means military action must serve a rational political purpose. Always.
So winning a battle isn't the goal in itself?
No. If your military victory doesn't actually achieve the political objective, maybe you conquer territory your government didn't even want, or you bankrupt yourself winning, then strategically, you've failed.
Military action has to be subordinate to the political aim.
Precisely. War can't just be, you know, senseless violence for its own sake. It needs that rational direction from the state.
And how does he build this theory? He starts with an interesting concept.
Yeah.
Absolute war.
Right. He introduces this idea of absolute war. It's like the pure, logical extreme of conflict. Unrestrained violence, escalating endlessly, aiming only for the complete destruction or overthrow of the enemy.
Like war in its purest, most violent form.
Exactly. But crucially, he says this is just a theoretical ideal, a concept on paper.
It doesn't actually happen.
No, because he immediately contrasts it with real war, Real war, the kind that actually happens, is always limited. It's constrained by politics, by chance, by human weakness, mistakes, and by what he famously calls friction.
Friction. We'll definitely get to that. But this method, start with the pure abstract idea, then immediately show how reality complicates it. That's classic Clausewitz.
It really is. It shows the tension between theory and practice.
So let's get into the mechanics of that real war. A key framework he uses is the Wondrous Trinity. Sounds almost mystical.
It does, but it's a very practical analytical tool. He says any conflict is driven by three dominant tendencies, three forces constantly interacting.
Who are there?
First, there's what he calls primordial violence, hatred, and enmity. This is the raw emotion, the irrational drive. Think of it as the people's element, the passion.
Got it. The gut feelings, the anger, the drive.
Second, there's the play of chance and probability. This is the realm of uncertainty, unpredictability. It's where the skill of the commander or the leader comes in, but also where pure luck plays a huge role. This is chance.
So things you can't fully control.
Really?
Unexpected.
Exactly. And third, there's its element of subordination as an instrument of policy. This is the rational part. The calculation, the strategy, the political goals set by the government or leadership. This is reason.
Passion, chance, and reason. The Trinity.
And the nature of any particular conflict, he argues, depends on how these three forces interact and which one happens to be dominant at the time. They're always pulling against each other.
Can you give an example outside of war? Like in business?
Sure. Think about a tech startup launching a product. You've got the team's intense belief in their creation, working crazy hours, that's passion.
Right.
Then unexpected bugs pop up. A competitor launches something similar. The market reacts weirdly, that's chance and probability.
The unpredictable stuff.
And overarching all that, you have the CEO on the board saying, okay, our goal is X market share within Y budget. That's the reason, the policy guiding the whole thing.
And success depends on keeping those three in some kind of balance.
Or at least aligned. Because they often pull in opposite directions. That tension.
Yeah.
That's where things get complicated. That's reality.
And that complexity, that tension, leads us perfectly into one of his most famous ideas. Friction.
Absolutely. This comes up strongly in books 2 and 3. Clausewitz was very critical of theories that tried to make war neat and predictable, like a math problem.
Why? Because it's just not.
Because of friction. Friction is it's everything that makes the simplest things difficult in practice.
So it's not just one big thing.
No, it's the accumulation of countless small, unexpected problems. Bad weather, orders getting lost, troops being tired, misunderstandings, equipment failing, the wrong map. It's all the little things that gum up the works.
It's the difference between the plan on paper and the messy reality on the ground.
Precisely. He has that great quote, "Everything in war is very simple, but the simplest thing is difficult." That difficulty is friction.
And that creates the fog of war, right? Where you never have perfect information.
Exactly. You're always operating with incomplete, often unreliable information because of friction. Things are murky.
So how do you deal with that? Just give up?
No, this is where he emphasizes what he calls military genius, which isn't just about being smart. It's about having the intuition, the determination, the sheer willpower to see through the fog and friction, make decisions under pressure, and stick to the objective.
It's a moral quality as much as an intellectual one. Resilience.
Very much so. It's that inner strength to overcome the inherent difficulties.
Okay, so friction makes execution hard. Military genius helps you push through. But where are you trying to go? What's the actual strategy?
Well, he defines strategy pretty simply in Book 3 as the use of engagements for the object of the war, meaning how you use individual battles or actions to achieve the overall political goal.
And a key part of that is identifying the target.
Yes, the center of gravity, or Schwerpunkt in German.
Schwerpunkt, what is that exactly?
It's the core source of the enemy's power, the hub. It could be their main army, their capital city, a key alliance, their leader, maybe even public opinion or a crucial economic resource.
It's the thing that if you can hit it, neutralize it.
The whole structure starts to crumble. It's about focusing your efforts where they'll have the biggest impact, not scattering them. Find the linchpin.
That makes sense. Now, one of the strategic arguments that really stood out to me, maybe because it feels counterintuitive today, is his point about defense.
Ah, yes. Book 6. He argues that defense is the stronger form of warfare.
Stronger. Really? We usually think of attack, aggression, taking initiative.
But think about the advantages of the defender. You're on familiar ground. Your supply lines are shorter. You can prepare your positions. And critically, you can wait.
Wait for what?
Wait for the attacker to make mistakes. Wait for them to overextend. The defender holds on to their strength while the attacker uses theirs up. Time is on the defender's side, generally.
But it sounds passive, like you're just letting them come at you.
It's not passive in a lazy way. It's a strategic waiting. The defender isn't just sitting there. They're conserving strength, preparing, looking for the right moment.
And right moment being?
The moment the attacker reaches their culminating point of attack.
Okay, what's the culminating point?
As an attacker advances, whether it's an army invading or, say, a company launching a huge aggressive marketing blitz, they expend energy. They take losses. Supplies get stretched. People get tired. Money runs out.
They start to lose momentum.
Exactly. They reach a point where their strength is diminished. They're overextended, potentially vulnerable. That peak point, just before they start to weaken significantly, that's the culminating point.
And that's when the defender should strike.
That's the ideal moment for the decisive counterattack. You've preserved your strength while they've spent theirs.
So in business, maybe a big company spends massively to enter a new market. They look dominant initially.
Right.
But 6 months later, their budget is blown, their team is exhausted. That's their culminating point. And a smaller, patient competitor who can surge resources can then make a move.
That's a perfect analogy. It's about understanding the dynamics of offensive exhaustion and defensive potential.
And this all ties back, as always with Clausewitz, to the overall plan, the political objective.
Yes. Book 8, On War Plans. The plan has to match the goal. He distinguishes between two main types of war based on the political aim.
Which are?
Total war, like the Napoleonic Wars he experienced, where the aim is to completely defeat the enemy, render them politically helpless, overthrow their government, maybe.
Okay, maximum objective.
Versus limited war, which was more common before Napoleon, like 18th century conflicts. Here, the aim is smaller, maybe gain a specific piece of territory, force a particular concession. You're not trying to crush the enemy entirely.
And your strategy, your war plan, has to be appropriate for which type of war you're fighting. You don't use total war methods for a limited objective.
Exactly. The means must match the ends. That constant link back to the political purpose is crucial.
It's this clarity, this insistence on purpose, that makes his ideas so useful beyond the military. Let's maybe crystallize some of those key themes and connect them to everyday life, maybe weaving in some of his memorable lines.
Good idea. Let's start with the big one. War as a continuation of politics, the primacy of purpose.
Right. So applied to work or life, always ask, what's the policy behind this action? Is this project, this meeting, this effort actually serving my main goal or the organization's main goal?
If it's not, then in Clausewitz's terms, it's just wasted effort, maybe even counterproductive, like fighting a battle for no strategic reason.
It's a great way to check if you're getting bogged down in stuff that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Strategic violence against your own time, as you put it earlier.
Mm-hmm. Then there's friction. The messy reality, remember. Everything in war is very simple, but the simplest thing is difficult.
That quote really resonates.
It tells us to expect things to go wrong. So in project management, for instance, the measure of success isn't just having a perfect plan. It's how the team adapts when things inevitably break or change or get delayed.
So value resilience over just planning. Don't punish every hiccup caused by friction. Reward the ability to navigate it.
Exactly. Which links to moral forces. Clausewitz emphasized courage. Courage, above all things, is the first quality of a warrior.
And again, not just physical courage.
No, it's the moral courage to make decisions under uncertainty, in the fog. It's about determination, morale, leadership. A small, motivated team with high morale can often outperform a larger, better resourced, but demoralized competitor. The human element is key.
The will to win can trump material advantage.
Often, yes. Then let's bring back the center of gravity, or Schwerpunkt. How can we apply that?
Well, in business strategy, instead of trying to match a competitor on every single front, identify their core strength, their Schwerpunkt.
What makes them tick? Their tech, brand loyalty, a key partnership.
Right. And then focus your resources on challenging that specific point or finding a way around it rather than spreading yourself too thin trying to fight them everywhere.
Like that startup example, maybe you can't beat the big company's cash. But you can attack their slowness, their bureaucracy, if that's their vulnerable center. Use focused strength, he said. The best strategy is always to be very strong, first in general, and then at the decisive point.
Concentrate your force. Makes sense. And what about that idea of defense being stronger? How does that apply?
It teaches patience, maybe. Protecting what you have, your market share, your customer base, your core strengths can be a more stable, powerful long-term strategy than constant risky expansion or attack.
So a smart leader knows when to consolidate, strengthen their position,
and wait for the aggressive competitor to overextend, to hit their culminating point before making a decisive move. It's strategic patience.
Okay, so for making big personal decisions then, you're facing uncertainty, incomplete information, your personal fog of war.
Yeah.
What does Clausewitz suggest?
Rely on your ultimate goal, your policy. What are you fundamentally trying to achieve? Use that as your guide. Combine your rational analysis with your intuition, your military genius, and act decisively based on your objective, rather than getting paralyzed by not knowing everything.
Don't let the fog stop you if the goal is clear.
Precisely. And for leaders, that wondrous trinity is gold. You have to constantly balance the team's passion and energy,
the irrational element,
with the unpredictable market forces, the chance,
the external chaos,
and the rational strategic goals set by the leadership, the reason. If any one of those gets out of whack, or if you ignore one, the whole thing can fall apart.
It's a constant balancing act. Stepping back from it all, the biggest thing I take away is that Clausewitz isn't giving answers. He's teaching a way to think about conflict, competition, uncertainty. It's a mental model.
I completely agree. It's not a how-to manual. It's a how-to-think manual. And what surprised me revisiting it is just how central the human element is. Morale, willpower, leadership, emotion. These aren't footnotes. They're often presented as the deciding factors.
Yeah. Despite all the strategy and logic, it comes down to people.
It often does.
And for me, the final enduring lesson has to be that primacy of purpose. Everything must serve a clear, rational objective. That quote about being strong generally, and then at the decisive point, it emphasizes focus. Action without purpose is just chaos, whether you're leading an army or just leading your own life.
So that clarity of purpose linked to action, that's what makes On War still relevant after almost 200 years.
Absolutely. A truly timeless work. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acantra Foundation.